Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the podcast that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, engineering, planning, art, and whoever else we can find that's out there trying to make the world a better place. I'm your host, Eric Kessel. Every once in a while, I come across something that just blows my mind, and late last year, I received a phone call from a friend who gave me a last-minute invite to see a portal done by Shared Studios. What's that? Hold on, we'll get there. It was during finals of last year, and I was super busy, but it was a trusted friend, so I said, okay, let's do this. What I found was a profound connection. In its simplest terms, a portal is a video conferencing facility stored in a shipping container. But that doesn't begin to do it justice. Shared Studios has, through their portal project, created a means to create connection between peoples all over the world. Maybe you're saying, so what? So does Skype. But it's more than that. It's an immersive experience that's curated and provides an opportunity to truly connect. Curators arrange deliberate conversations, and full-scale screens make you feel like you're truly talking to someone face-to-face, even when that person is on the other side of the world. The Portal Project is about connection, and I came away changed. Portals have been used to do cultural exchange, share performances, initiate global discussions, and conduct business incubators. Joining us today is Michelle Mukhtadir. Michelle is co-founder of Shared Studios and runs Global Development. Previously, she was a multimedia journalist based in the Middle East. She has written for Reuters, CNN, The Huffington Post, and the Energy Intelligence Group, and previously worked as a community organizer across the U.S. Today, she'll be sharing with us the story and vision of the Portal Project, and I know you're going to learn a lot. Let's get to the interview. Michelle, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
I referenced it briefly in the introduction. I had to get you on the show. I had to tell the story of Shared Studios because a couple of months ago I was invited to one that just happened to be in my neighborhood. And before I walked through the door, I had no idea what a portal was. I sort of found out about it through experiencing it. And I knew from that moment I wanted someone to come on the show and tell our listeners about this amazing project. I wonder if we could start, though, we'll tease out the anticipation a little bit and start a little bit with you and kind of how you came to be involved in the Portal Project. And you coming from a background in journalism, I mean, I think the story of how this project got started has always so intrigued me since I first started researching it like that day. How did this get started? What drew you into this?
So I used to be a journalist and I was mostly covering Iran for an American audience. I was based in the Middle East. I was writing for Reuters. And I was really excited about telling the story of Iran and of this big country of, you know, over 70 million to a wider audience. You know, when I had the opportunity at Reuters, I would take the chance to write about Iran's art scene or their entrepreneurial scene or the environment. And I got a lot of positive feedback when I would write those stories. But as you can imagine, this was December 2014. A lot of the talk at the time was about nuclear negotiations and sanctions. So really the news of the day dominated the story. And so I found myself writing the same story again and again. And I could see that my readership really enjoyed when I would, you know, I wrote this story about this art gallery in Iran where people would go in and scream into these huge human-sized pots just to kind of release their frustration. And this was like a performance art. And people loved that story. I wrote about like a young jazz group in Iran. I wrote about their challenges. You know, some of the lakes and rivers have dried up because of part of mismanagement, climate change, you name it. But that's a global problem. And, you know, they need help addressing it. I felt a little frustrated that, you know, at the end of the day, I could only write so many stories. I was limited to my words. I was limited to my sources. And I really wanted to kind of expand the stories of Iran to a greater audience. So that's when Amar Bakshi, who I used to work with at CNN, gave me a call. And we caught up and he said, hey, Michelle, I have this idea where you step inside of wasn't called a portal yet. He said, you step inside a space and it feels like you're in the same room. And you can speak with somebody in a different part of the country or different part of the world. And it really feels like you're in that same room together. What do you think about it? And I just jumped at the idea. I was like, that's great. You should put one in the Middle East. And I initially didn't think Iran would bite because it's, you know, it's a difficult country to operate in. It's difficult to launch new initiatives. but I was really driven by how difficult it was and I wanted to make it happen. So I shopped it around to different artists, different groups that I met. And the next time I went to Iran, I actually met with a few art galleries and I told them about this idea. Some people said it was crazy or that's nice, but it's never going to happen. But then I met Sohrab Kashani, who is an artist in Iran who's actually used technology as a medium in his work before. He couldn't come to the U.S. once because of visa problems. So he had this woman walk around the U.S. as his human avatar.
Wait, how does that work?
She basically wore like a Google Glass and he would be talking in her ear and he could see what she was seeing. And it was for like this conference. So he was able to sort of be there virtually and speak through her. He was totally game for this idea. And we launched in his gallery and a gallery in the Lower East Side in New York a year after Amar and I had that first conversation. I was really excited about kind of removing myself from the being the one that's telling the world what's going on in Iran. I wanted Iranians to tell the world what was going on in their own words, sharing their own stories. And I wanted to be bidirectional because when I would go to Iran, I would also notice that they would ask me questions like, is it true that, you know, on American college campuses, kids are really running around streaking? Does that really happen? You know, like they were curious about life, you know, they wanted to know what college was like. Was it like what they saw in the movies? And so when we launched our first portal between New York and Tehran, you know, and people stayed in the portal for 50 minutes, I realized that, you know, this was kind of fulfilling that dream.
You know, everybody who comes on this show has some kind of aha moment where they're trying out an idea or they build a prototype and it's like, aha, like, okay, like I'm really on to something here. Was that it? I mean, I seem to remember reading that the initial visit to the portals is planned at 8 minutes and you guys gradually figured out that people just really wanted to stay, like they were embracing that connection. Was that what did it? Like people were just hanging out in there and you said, okay, this is an idea that we're really going to run with.
When we first started, we had set up blocks of 5 to 10 minutes for conversations. We thought that people would know what to talk about. They would run out of things to say. We also launched in New York and, you know, everybody's super busy and needs to be at the next coolest thing in New York. So we kept it to max 10 minutes. But what we found, and it was slow, obviously slow that first week, when we didn't have somebody else waiting in line, we just let them stay inside or just we didn't pull them out. And they stayed in for about 40 to 50 minutes to the point that we had to knock and say, hey, you know, you've been in here for 40 minutes. Did you know that? And a lot of people were like, oh, my God, I had no idea. You know, each of our portals is staffed by a local curator. So they're really responsible for inviting people to come participate. But sometimes they do the translations. And I did some of those first translations for those first 2 weeks. And I remember people would go in and they talked about everything from love to their worries. When we had people go inside, we gave them a prompt because sometimes people feel uncomfortable speaking to strangers, as you can imagine. And so the prompt was really simple, but personal and aspirational. It was, what would make today a good day for you? And I remember this one girl in Iran, she said, if it rained. And this young man on the US side said, why? It typically sucks when it rains. And she said, well, in Tehran, we're surrounded by mountains. It's really polluted. But when it rains, we get a little bit of respite from all of the pollution in the city. And he's like, why is it so polluted? She's like, well, we are unable to get properly refined petroleum for our cars because of sanctions. And so we're using this really crummy fuel in the cars and it makes the air really hard to breathe in. And also, you know, we're surrounded by these mountains, so it also traps in the air. And so it was memorable for me, but I know it was memorable for him. And it kind of touched on the global issues, you know, of sanctions, of, you know, being blockaded, but done through a really personal way and with no real like agenda. And I think that's what was really important about the portal is that this was a safe space where people are talking about anything and they feel comfortable doing so because we place them in trusted communities. So our partner in Iran was an art gallery that had been operating for years and they had their own, you know, trusted community. And it was also, we weren't mandating anything. It wasn't like go inside and have an argument or have a debate or learn about XYZ. It was just go in and have this experience and hopefully it's memorable. And I think people today, everything we do, it feels like there's an agenda or purpose or we're getting sold something. And here we were just saying, nope, go in and create your own meaning with somebody. And to many people, that's daunting, but I hope it's also, you know, freeing. And so after that first portal, when people came out and they were crying and they were giddy or laughing, and, you know, somebody said it was like therapy. We had this Iranian-American dancer who had never met his family in Iran before. He was able to perform for them live inside of the portal, and he came out crying, and he said, I felt like I was breathing the same air as them. That gave me goosebumps and made me cry, and I try to, you know, when I look at things that I want to pursue, relationships I want to have, you know, I look and see what gives me goosebumps. And the portal, those connections, that those first 2 weeks really did that. And that was definitely the aha moment for me.
So tell me a little bit more about the curation. You mentioned that you have curators. And for me, you know, when I went to the portal, that made all the difference. I mean, I think it would be kind of an awkward thing to just walk into a box and start talking to a stranger and not have anyone sort of shaping and helping that experience for you. How do you pick curators? Where do they come from? What motivates them? Who are they?
Each of our portal curators, they sort of serve as community organizers. They are the face, the eyes, ears of our portal in each city. They tend to be, you know, really outgoing, and they know their community really well, and they have trust within their community. They're very well networked, so that if we say, hey, we're going to have a global event inviting librarians across the world, they can invite librarians. Or they can do something as crazy as, okay, we want to invite graffiti artists and have them perform together inside of the portal, or have breakdancers come inside of the portal.
Breakdancers.
Breakdancers, opera singers, pinata makers, you name it. Like, if you, as specific as you want to get, our curators are able to kind of maneuver through their communities and get the right people to participate. For example, in Afghanistan, we had a request from a school in New York, high school. They were having a class on Cold War history, and they said, we would love to connect to a country across the world that's experienced the Cold War in a way that we haven't. We said, okay, well, maybe Afghanistan. They were really affected by the Cold War. So we told our portal curator, like, do you think you can invite anybody to come speak about their experience living in Afghanistan during the Cold War? They ended up finding a professor of Cold War history who had actually fought for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan at the time. And he came in, he spoke about his experience. He spoke about, you know, how they teach the Cold War in Afghanistan to this class in New York. I would never have thought to do that. So what we really encourage in the portal, and what we've found, I think, liberating, is that people come inside of the portal and they realize that it is a tool that they can use to enhance their current work, their life, and our curators are the ones that make it happen.
You know, free and open communication is always an ideal. It's an ideal for people and artists and free thinkers. It's not always ideal for governments and bureaucracies and that sort of thing. What have the challenges have been? And am I correct in my assumption that one of the challenges is, you know, running afoul of people saying truth the way that it is, and people not wanting that truth to get out onto a global platform?
Anytime we launch a portal, we let our local partners guide us. So in Iran, when we placed a portal in an art gallery, we were very cognizant about using this prompt that was personal. And we made sure that when people went inside, that they weren't going in leading the conversation with, you know, how do you feel about your nuclear program? Although people still did that. You know, I asked them in Iran, is your government censoring your internet? Like, how is this going to work? And they're like, they turned to me and they said, the government's censoring your internet too.
Yeah.
And I was like, true. So, you know, people were free to talk about whatever they wanted to. And if they ever felt uncomfortable, they could always leave. And we weren't having conversations about how to overthrow XYZ. People were having conversations about their lives. And I think they wanted to have these conversations. And we weren't doing anything that would make us worried or make our partners worried. And if we ever did, they would tell us and we would stop. But, you know, we focused in the art space because we wanted to avoid setting ourselves up to have conversations that could be sensitive, that could be perceived as trying to implement some sort of policy change or whatnot. Like, that's not what we were trying to do. And also, if you just look at it from a technical perspective, what we were doing was like having a Skype conversation. You know, and we were one of billions of people having a Skype conversation that day, you know. So on a technical point, it wasn't really anything special. It's just that, like, we physicalized it. And I think coming out into a public space and having these conversations really changes the way that you interact with that person. It makes you be more respectful. It makes you be more nuanced. So even if you disagree, even if you're talking about something heated, you see how that person is sitting or standing or moving, and you adjust based on how they respond physically. to what you say.
It's amazing that you use that term, public space. I mean, we had a lot of episodes in our first 2 years about the financialization, the capitalization of public space. And a lot of public spaces aren't public anymore, right?
Yep.
And they don't necessarily belong to the government. I mean, they belong to advertisers and these sorts of people. And I think that's another thing that I just love about your work. It's creating a new form of public space, which actually segues pretty well. Let's talk about scale for a little bit. We've mostly zeroed in on Tehran and New York, but how many countries are you in now?
Good question. We're in about 40 different locations across the world. I would have to do the math to see which the number of countries, but probably, you know, 30 countries around the world, from Myanmar to Mexico to Honduras to Sweden to Germany to Iraq, Jordan, Rwanda. So we're in a lot of places now. And really, Portal serves today as a sort of permanent interconnected global community space for collaboration, for debate, where we encourage people to engage with difference, and we hope to celebrate diversity through the portal. You know, we don't say go inside and fall in love with the person that you're speaking to, but we want people to go in and respect what that person has to say and learn from what that person has to say and engage in sort of a vigorous yet respectful debate, which I think is one of our challenges today with, you know, the rise of technology and social media. It's really easy to connect with whoever we want across the world and have these conversations. But we're often cocooning ourselves in like-minded communities. And when we do have somebody that disagrees with us, we either bully them into silence, we hide their post, for example. And what we're trying to do is create, you know, these safe spaces in public areas where people can engage in a more nuanced, civil discussion about challenging topics.
It's crazy, isn't it, that in 2018, that's a radical idea, that we would have a public space where people would be civil to one another. But I guess this is where we are. And thank you for the work that you do to reverse this trend of hostility.
We like to say we're revitalizing public space, but we also like to say we need to revitalize our public discourse.
You're listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. We hope you've been enjoying these thoughts from Michelle Mochtender of Shared Studios about the origins of this amazing project. But we're going to take a quick break. While we're breaking, check us out on social media, where you can find out more about the Portal Project and how to get involved. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Social Design Insights, and on Twitter at Social Design IM. When we get back, we're going to be talking more about the Portal Project and what's in store for the future. And Michelle's going to give us all some insight about how we can scale our best ideas. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more Social Design Insights after the break. Welcome back to Social Design Insights. We've been speaking with Michelle Mochtender of Shared Studios about the origins of the amazing Portal Project and its many implications. Coming up, we're going to drill down and talk about how we can use technology to create genuine human connection. Let's rejoin the conversation already in motion. How does a new location come about? You know, you rattled off a lot of countries. Are you getting invitations from places and saying, hey, come put a portal here? If you get a lot of invitations, how do you be strategic about where a portal is going to go? How does a new location come about?
Well, most of our growth has been organic. Obviously, we were really intentional when we started that first portal between New York and Tehran. And the reason why we chose these two places is because there is this, you know, it's challenging for people from both countries to travel to the respective countries. And we thought this portal could really kind of collapse that distance. But as we've grown, people have reached out. I mean, in Afghanistan, the way that we launched our portal there, which has been our longest running portal for over 4 years now, was somebody, a computer science professor in Herat, Afghanistan, heard about us through the BBC Persian, and he reached out and he said, hey, you should put a portal here. Everybody thinks we're just the Taliban, but we have a lot of other stuff going on in Afghanistan, and the world needs to know and hear from us. And we said, okay, well, you need an internet, you need electricity, you need a shipping container, and you need an active community that's going to use it. obviously, we didn't think anything was going to come from this, but he wrote back 2 weeks later, and he was standing in the middle of a shipping container yard, and he said, I've chosen this container. And so we launched a month later between Herat, Afghanistan, and Georgetown University. They had like a ribbon cutting ceremony, and the portal has been active in the city for 4 years now. Women use it, men use it, kids. We have jam sessions between musicians. So it's one of our really active, long-running sites. That's just one example of how a portal came to be. For that specific one, we applied for grant funding. People pay to place portals. So this can be a university, a city, a community space. Even sometimes companies will sponsor portals. And we're a social enterprise, so we will sponsor and fund portals that can't necessarily fund it, because we believe everybody has a value to add to the network. So for example, we now sponsor that portal in Afghanistan. And, you know, we sponsor the portal at the internally displaced person camp in Erbil, Iraq. And, you know, the portal in Oakland is paid for by a local bank. It's not fully a TOMS model, but we do try to a degree, you know, provide a series of sponsored sites each year.
Once you select a site, it's permanent, yes? I mean, that's the intention.
That's the intention. Obviously, if we find that the community is not utilizing it, or maybe the location isn't conducive enough to connections, like there's not enough foot traffic, people aren't, you know, if they don't use it, we'll take it away. You know, this isn't something where we like force people to use it. All the interactions are, you know, voluntary. We don't pay people to use portals. People come in and they use them if they want to. So if there's demand on the ground, we'll stay there. If there's not, we'll either move cities or move locations. You know, in Mexico, we've been there for 3.5, almost 4 years now, but we switched locations. So we'll be in one place for about 3-4 months and then we'll move. Right now we're located right outside of a really busy park and, you know, technology museum. So we get a lot of foot traffic. So we've now been there for 2 years. So we're flexible. We will move if we see that it's not fulfilling our objectives.
Let's talk about objectives for a second. One of the defects of hosting a show is that you tend to project your own dreams onto other people's work, and then you get really excited and you bring them on the show. So I hope you'll humor me with this next question. But is the portal, has it been a conduit to other forms of engagement? Because in my imagination, you know, two people meet in a portal and have some sort of exchange, whether it's, you know, in a business incubator or a dance performance or a conversation, and that leads to some other form of involvement. Like, have two people met in a portal and then started a business together or something like that?
We have had people meet through the portal, then they stayed in touch, and then they traveled actually to that respective country and they met in person. This happened with one of our location in Berlin. Our team in Berlin actually became the tour guide and showed them around. We've had portal marriages, but they've been in the same location. But I will say one of the things that has happened in the portal and what our mission is to connect people who normally wouldn't meet. And we hope that through that, people's lives will be enriched. This doesn't have to just mean people that they're separated from due to distance. It can be people within their own city who they normally wouldn't meet. I've met some of my best friends in D.C. through a portal in Art Basel, Miami Beach. And I didn't meet them in D.C. And I wonder, I'm like, why didn't I meet you in D.C.? And it's something about, like, I'm not going and engaging with my city in the same way I do as when I'm, you know, in the portal. Let me give you one example of how people have used portals in ways that we didn't think they would. And I think that, and they've gone on to sort of start businesses together. We collaborated with Johns Hopkins University, their Center for Bioinnovation, Engineering, and Design, to host a collaborative hackathons with students in Lebanon through portals. They were looking to solve public health challenges that the refugee populations in Lebanon faced. So we had groups of about 35 students on each side. We broke them up into groups of five, and they all worked on a problem together, whether it may be access to clean water for the populations, how they keep track of their vaccines, how they are managing waste disposal. So the students in Lebanon would actually go to these refugee camps and they would meet with the populations there and they would see their problems. And they would use the portal to access the resources at Johns Hopkins University, the mentors, the expertise, and they would develop products that they could then go test out, whether it was like a makeshift water filter. Or one of the problems that they faced was that the refugee populations in Lebanon were burning garbage to stay warm. that was leading to a lot of lung and respiratory problems. Obviously, it was bad for the environment. So rather than say, hey, stop burning the garbage, what they did was develop this netting where they would put the garbage inside, and then the netting would serve as insulation inside of their tents. So that team is looking to, they've applied for funding, they're still in touch, and they're hoping to bring that to market in the next year. So that's just an example of the kind of power of collaborating with people you normally wouldn't meet. You're able to kind of take what your knowledge is and put it in place in locations you would never think to operate. And that's very exciting for people and for youth, especially for students. You know, when I grew up, I was writing papers by myself, reading books and doing research. In my life now, I don't do that. I collaborate with people. I speak to them and then we do projects together. And this is what the portal does. The portal allows for these types of environments in universities and for other populations. It's a very real, kind of brings the real world to universities, which I find very important for learning today.
Let's talk about the future a little bit. You know, this feels like one of those ideas that could just scale infinitely, you know, like a portal in every city and in every neighborhood, you know, a sort of global network of people talking about ideas and exchanging futures and feelings and all this stuff. And as we discussed, you know, the sort of public square that we lost in the neoliberal era. What does the future look like to you and shared studios?
Well, we hope to have portals in locations all across the world so that the portals network really turns into this permanent network of interconnected spaces that are used for collaboration, that are used for debate. Let's say you're, in Berkeley and you're walking to class one day and you step inside the portal very easily and you're connected to Rwanda. You know, we want that to be simple and we want to be able to kind of disrupt people's day-to-day lives with these whimsical, beautiful encounters. Apart from just the physicality of the network, we want people to see that they have value and that if they have a problem or if they have an idea, they can socialize it across the world in a meaningful, real way through the portals network. To give you an example, you know, we have a portal in Milwaukee that is in a neighborhood with the highest rate of incarceration of Black males. And there's a lot of gang violence. There's a lot of gun violence and also like warring factions between the gangs. We actually connected that portal to Afghanistan, where they also have problems with tribal altercations. And we brought in people from both of those communities to discuss how they resolve conflict. It was amazing to see how the folks in Afghanistan learned from how our curator in Milwaukee was using the portal to kind of ease conflict. It allows you to access the kind of wealth of the world without needing to travel, without needing to know everybody around the world. You know, not everybody has a global network. But with portals, once you're involved, you can access our network freely. It makes it really easy to socialize those ideas across large areas with, yeah. So I hope that made sense.
No, it did. And I think, you know, that's the beautiful spirit of this project is, you know, using technology. And I'm already starting to notice a theme in this series that, you know, technology is a means to humanity, you know, and a humanity that was perhaps we lost a little bit of, you know, in modernization. And we've become very sort of siloed behind national boundaries, behind neighborhood boundaries and these sorts of things. So, you know, I think the work that you're doing, maybe the reason it resonates so much with me is that it touches that. It speaks to that. It says, you know, hey, these gang members in Milwaukee and these residents of Afghanistan have something to say to each other strictly for the fact that they're both human and they're both dealing with conflict. And I think it's a beautiful, wonderful idea. And thank you so much for coming on the show. I can't wait to get all of our listeners to go to this project. And
yes, please,
and any of them in the
them.
Bay Area that want to come with me, I'm definitely going to be going back with my students.
We would be happy to organize a special visit, special, you know, thematic connections. And feel free to make requests, the kind of crazier the better. Like, I never thought we'd be having hackathons through the portal. You know, I never thought we'd be having rap battles between Gaza and Milwaukee. So it's been cool to see people be creative and realize what they are thinking about inside of our network.
So cool. Well, thanks again for coming on the show, Michelle. This has been lovely.
Thank you so much for having me. Looking forward to hopefully meeting one day in person or in a portal.
You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. I'd like to thank my guest of the week, Michelle Mochteder of Shared Studios, for lending us her time and for her inspiring work. I think one of the best things you could ever say about technology is that it brings us together. But for what and who? Sometimes that connection is really just between consumer and advertiser, or between troll and victim. Utilizing the promise of technology to create genuine human connection between peoples that need it is one of the most inspiring things I've seen in a while, and it gives me hope for the world. And I hope you check out our website to learn more and find out if there's a portal in your city, currystonefoundation.org. If there is, definitely make time to check it out. And if you end up in Oakland, let me know and we can go together. If you have any feedback on the show, ideas for guests, or just want to chat, you can write to me at eric@socialdesigninsights.com. That's E-R-I-C at socialdesigninsights.com. Join us next week. We'll be coming back to the Bay and talking with Hal Aronson of We Care Solar about a remarkable device developed by Hal and his wife and how it's come to change the lives of so many. Social Design Insights is produced by Baruch Zeigner. And at the break, we were listening to Communique by my old pals Dire Straits off their self-titled album, Dire Straits. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Foundation. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Social Design Insights and on Twitter at Social Design IN for all the latest news on social impact design and occasional pics of me living the glamorous life of a podcast host.